beliefs, the foundation for creating change in human state and human behavior. In his wonderful book, Anatomy of an Illness, Norman Cousins tells an instructive story about Pablo Casals, one of the great musicians of the 20th century. It's a story of belief and renewal, and we can all learn from it. Cousins says that it was almost painful to watch the old man as he began his day. His frailty and arthritis were so debilitating that he needed to help him in dressing. His emphysema was evident in his labored breathing. He walked with a shuffle, stooped over, his head pitched forward, his hands were swollen, his fingers clenched. He looked like a very old, very tired man. Even before eating, he made his way to the piano, though, one of the several instruments on which Casals had become proficient. With great difficulty, he arranged himself on the piano bench. It seemed a terrible effort for him to bring his clenched, swollen fingers to the keyboard. And then something quite miraculous happened. Casals suddenly and completely transformed himself before Cousins' eyes. He went into a resourceful state, and as he did, his physiology changed to such a degree that he began to move and play and produce, both in his body and on the piano, results that should have been possible only for a healthy, strong, flexible pianist. As Cousins put it, quote, "The fingers slowly unlocked and reached toward the keys like the buds of a plant toward the sunlight. His back straightened. He seemed to breathe more freely," unquote. The very thought of playing the piano totally changed his state and thus the effectiveness of his body. Casals began playing some of Bach's work with great sensitivity and control. He then launched into a Brahms concerto, and his fingers seemed to race above the keyboard. Cousins wrote, "His entire body seemed fused with the music. It was no longer stiff and shrunken, but supple and graceful and completely freed of its arthritic coils. By the time he walked away from the piano, he seemed entirely different from the person who'd sat down to play. He stood straighter and taller. He walked without the trace of a shuffle. He immediately walked to breakfast, ate heartily, and then went out for a stroll along the beach." We usually think of beliefs in terms of creeds or doctrines, and that's what many beliefs are. But in the most basic sense, a belief is any guiding principle, dictum, faith, or passion that can provide meaning and direction in life. Unlimited stimuli are available to us. Beliefs are the prearranged, organized filters to our perceptions of the world. Beliefs are like commanders of the brain. When we congruently believe something is true, it is like delivering a command to our brain as to how to represent what is occurring. Casals believed in music and in art. That's what had given beauty and order and nobility to his life, and that's what would still provide daily miracles for him. Because he believed in the transcendent power of his art, he was empowered in a way that almost defies understanding. His beliefs transformed him daily from a tired old man to a vital genius. In the most profound sense, they kept him alive. John Stuart Mill once wrote, "One person with a belief is equal to a force of 99 who have only interests." That's precisely why beliefs open the door to excellence. Beliefs deliver a direct command to your nervous system. When you believe something is true, you literally go into the state of it being true. Handled effectively, beliefs can be the most powerful forces for creating good in our lives. On the other hand, beliefs that limit your actions and thoughts can be as devastating as resourceful beliefs can be empowering. Religions throughout history have empowered millions of people and given them strength to do things they thought they could not. Beliefs help us to tap the richest resources deep within us, creating and directing these resources in the support of our desired outcomes. In fact, there is no more powerful directing force in human behavior than belief. In essence, human history is really the history of human belief. The people who changed history, whether it be Christ, Muhammad, Copernicus, Columbus, Edison, or Einstein, they've all been people who've changed our beliefs. To change our behaviors, we've got to start with changing our beliefs. If we want to model excellence, we need to learn to model the beliefs of those who have achieved excellence. The more we learn about human behavior, the more we learn about the extraordinary power that beliefs have over our lives. In many ways, that power defies the logical models most of us have. But it's clear that even at the level of physiology, beliefs, which are nothing but congruent internal representations, control our reality. A remarkable study was done on schizophrenia not long ago. One case involved a woman with a split personality. Normally, her blood sugar levels were completely normal, but when she believed she was a diabetic, her whole physiology changed to become that of a diabetic. Her belief had become her reality. In a similar vein, there have been numerous studies in which a person in a hypnotic trance is touched with a piece of ice and told that it's actually a piece of hot metal. Invariably, a blister will develop at the point of contact. What counted was not reality, but belief, the direct, unquestioned communication to the nervous system. The brain simply does what it's told. Most of us are aware of the placebo effect. People who are told a drug will have a certain effect will many times experience that effect, even when an empty pill with no active properties is given. Norman Cousins, who learned firsthand the power of belief in eliminating his own illness, concludes, quote, "Drugs are not always necessary. Belief in recovery always is," unquote. One remarkable placebo study concerned a group of patients with bleeding ulcers. They were divided into two groups. People in the first group were told that they were being given a new drug that would absolutely produce relief. Those in the second were told they were being given an experimental drug, but that very little was known about its effect. 70% of those in the first group experienced significant relief from their ulcers. Only 25% of the second group had a similar result. In both cases, patients received a drug with no medicinal properties at all. The only difference was the belief system they adopted. Even more remarkable are the numerous studies of people who, given drugs known to have harmful effects, have experienced no ill effects at all when they were told that they would experience a positive outcome. Studies conducted by Dr. Andrew Weil, an MD and graduate of Harvard University, have shown that the experiences of drug users correspond almost exactly to their expectations. He found he could lead a person giving a dose of amphetamines to feel sedated, or a person given a barbiturate to feel stimulated. The magic of drugs resides within the mind of the user, not in the drugs, Weil concluded. In all these instances, the one constant that most powerfully affected the results was belief, the consistent, congruent message delivered to the brain and nervous system. For all its power, there is no abstruse magic involved in the process. Belief is nothing but a state, an internal representation that governs behavior. It's a feeling of certainty about something. It can be an empowering belief in possibility, a belief that we will succeed in something or achieve something, or it can be a disempowering belief, a belief that we can't succeed, that our limitations are clear, intractable, and overwhelming. If you believe in success, you'll be empowered to achieve it. If you believe in failure, those messages will tend to lead you to experience that as well. Remember, whether you say you can do something or whether you say you can't, you're right. Both kinds of beliefs have great power. The question is, what kinds of beliefs are best to have, and how do we develop them? I believe the birth of excellence really begins with our awareness that our beliefs are a choice. We usually don't think of them that way, but they are. They're just programmed feelings about what is true and not in the world, and we can change them. Where do we get our beliefs? Well, there are basically five sources. Our environment, that is what we grow up in, the environment we live in, gives us models of success or failure, about what is right and wrong, about what is possible and impossible. One of the most difficult things about slum life is that children grow up with few models, if any, that would lead them to believe that they could produce greater results in their life. We see the same challenge in families on the welfare system, where we now have third generations that are still on welfare. They have no other model of possibility. They believe that is how life is. They believe they have no other choice, and so they experience their life as having limited choice. Another source of beliefs comes from events that we've experienced in our life. Various experiences that we have cause us to believe certain things. I know when I was growing up, I was very fortunate to have experiences where I went out and tried things. I tried to interview successful business people, successful sports writers and sportscasters and athletes, and I succeeded in several cases. This caused me to believe that individuals of power, individuals of influence, were accessible, that I too could be like them, that I could learn to produce new results. That belief caused me to continue to take actions later in my future. A third way that beliefs are fostered is through knowledge. What you know and what you don't know both affect your beliefs. If you know the earth is flat, you're going to behave differently than if you know the earth is round. Knowledge makes a big difference. So we want to continually educate ourselves so we develop the kinds of beliefs that empower us versus limit us. A fourth way in which beliefs are formulated is by the results we've achieved in the past. If you've attempted to do something in the past and you've succeeded, you tend to believe that you can do it again. If, on the other hand, you have never succeeded and attempted something many times, it becomes difficult to believe that you could succeed now. So past results definitely have an impact in people's belief structures. Finally, the most important way in which we can establish new beliefs is by creating results in advance. That is, by setting clear enough goals that we step into and begin to experience as true, we can begin to develop a new set of beliefs about what is really possible in our lives, and that can begin to drive us forward. Take out a piece of paper if you would. Okay, now make a list of at least five positive beliefs that can now serve to support you in achieving your goals. If you were going to create five beliefs for yourself that would empower you to be, do, and share more, what would they be? Write them down now, stop the tape, and then come back. So now you have five beliefs that you'd like to adopt. Let me help you by adding more. In my modeling of human excellence, I have found that people who succeed consistently seem to share certain belief systems, and I'd like to share a few of them with you. These are not the only key beliefs, obviously, but they're a good start to add to your list. Here's the first one. People who succeed on a large scale seem to believe, belief number one, that everything happens for a reason and a purpose, and that it serves them. Remember the story of W. Mitchell? What was the central belief that helped him to overcome adversity? He decided to take what happened to him and make it work for him, in whatever way he could. In the same way, all successful people I've studied have an uncanny ability to focus on what is possible in a situation, on what positive results can come from whatever's happened to them. No matter how much negative feedback they get from the environment, they think in terms of possibilities. They think that everything happens for a reason, and it serves them. And because they believe this, they find benefits out of almost any adversity. Let's face it, in life, many things will happen to us that we'll have no explanation for. We have no idea of why it's happened and what it's occurred. Sometimes we do everything right and it still turns up wrong, and that's the truth. That's how life is. But if we can offer ourselves and operate from the belief that everything in life happens for a reason and a purpose and it serves us, then by having that belief alone, we'll find a benefit. We'll find a way to make that useful. It allows us to continue to take action instead of being immobilized by the pain or challenges that have beset us. A second key belief that I've modeled from successful individuals is that they believe that there is no such thing as failure, that there are only results. This is almost a corollary belief to number one. Most people in our culture have been programmed to fear this thing called failure. Yet all of us can think of times when we wanted one thing and we got another. We've all flunked a test, suffered through those frustrating romances that didn't work out, or put together a business plan only to see everything go awry. You'll notice in this tape program that I use the word outcome and the word results quite a bit, because that's exactly what successful people see. They don't see failure. They don't even believe in it. It doesn't compute. People always succeed in getting some sort of result. The super successes of our culture aren't people who don't fail, but simply people who know that if they try something and if it doesn't work, they can just try something else. They've had a learning experience. They use what they've learned and simply try something else again. They take some new actions and produce some new results. Think about it. What's the one asset, the one benefit you have today over yesterday? The answer, of course, is experience. People who fear failure make internal representations of what might not work in advance. And this is what keeps them from taking the very action that can ensure the accomplishment of their desires. Are you afraid of failure? Well, how do you feel about learning? You can learn from every human experience and thereby always succeed in anything you do. Let me give you an example of someone's life history. This is a man who failed in business at the age of 31. He was defeated in his legislative race at the age of 32. He failed again in business at the age of 34. He overcame the death of his sweetheart at the age of 35. He had a nervous breakdown at the age of 36. He lost an election at the age of 38. He lost a congressional race at the age of 43. He lost another congressional race at the age of 46. He lost another congressional race at the age of 48. He lost a senatorial race at the age of 55. He failed in his efforts to become Vice President of the United States at age 56. He lost another senatorial race at the age of 58. And he was elected President of the United States at age 60. The man whose life's history I've shared with you is a man named Abraham Lincoln. Anytime you start thinking success is easy or that there are no challenges in life, take another look around at the people who've succeeded on a large scale. Could Abraham Lincoln have become President of the United States if he'd seen his election losses as failures? It's not likely. There's a famous story about Thomas Edison. After he tried 9,999 times to perfect the light bulb and hadn't succeeded, someone asked him, "Are you going to have 10,000 failures?" He answered, "I didn't fail. I just discovered another way not to invent the electric light bulb." What he had discovered was another set of actions that produced another set of results.
There are only results. These people who are truly the super achievers, those people that people throughout this culture like to talk about, read about, write about. What really set them apart was they got themselves to take action, and the reason they got themselves to take action is they didn't believe there was such a thing as failure. No matter what happened, they just looked at it as a result. They looked at it as an outcome. And if it was not the result that they intended, they simply learned from what occurred and changed their approach and took more action. And if that didn't work, what do? Changed again. If that didn't work, what do? Changed again. Now, the trap most of us fall into is we intend a certain kind of result to occur. We don't get the result, and we call it what?
Failure.
And the reality is there are no failures because we always succeed in producing a result, don't we? Remember last night I talked to you about, you know, this woman comes and says, you know, I weigh 285 pounds and she's all upset, right? I said, look, get excited. You produced a massive result. Called excess weight on a large scale. I mean, that took effort, didn't it? I mean, you have to work at that. She had to eat a certain way, think a certain way. She had to produce specific actions to get that result. So instead of going, oh, it's a failure and feeling bad, feel excited about the fact that few people have been able to produce that result. Now, if you say, but I don't like the result, say, well, that's fine. At least now you know how to produce that. If you know anybody who ever wants to beef up, you can explain how. Now, if you don't like the result, then all you have to do is find someone who is thin and find out what they are doing and do the same things. Doesn't that make sense? Find out what they're doing in their mind, how they look at food, how they think about food, how they move their body, how they exercise, what they eat, how much they eat, and see if you can't model that. And if you sow similar seeds, you'll produce similar results. Then you'll produce a result called being thin. But here's the key. As long as this woman holds all this pain and anguish and hurt and feelings of failure about being overweight, do you think that's going to assist her in her ability to lose weight? Yes or no? There's no way. It literally becomes an emotional blockage. It changes her self-image into failure and literally becomes this immobilizing factor that keeps her from being thin. See? So you've got to let go of that. I worked with an Olympic athlete several years ago who was a high jumper. He was one of the top high jumpers in the world about 4 or 5 years ago. And all of a sudden, for 2 years, he couldn't jump his hat size. And so he asked me if I'd come out and work out with him and see what it was and see if I could assist him. I said, no problem. Well, all I had to do was watch him jump one time to see what the problem was. Here he goes. He gets himself lined up. Sure enough, he goes for the jump, and just as he takes off, he has a poor takeoff, and he hits the bar. So when he gets off on the other side, he jumps up and he starts screaming at himself inside. Now, not out loud screaming, but you know what I'm talking about by screaming? I mean, it's like so angry with himself and he's cursing, going, God, and he's saying all these filthy words to himself. And I pulled him over and I said, look, if you want me to work with you, I'll never see that again. I said, that's the reason why you're not producing the result you want. Because every time you produce a result, when it's not the one you intended, instead of going, wow, that's great, I produced a result, I learned something. I learned that if I take off here, I'll hit this bar here. Instead of doing that, what you're doing is you're programming yourself with failure. You're carrying around this negative emotional baggage. And when you go to jump the next time, that emotional baggage is there. It's affecting your self-image, and it's affecting the way you use your nervous system. I said, I want to see you every single time when you get off there, whether you hit the bar or whether you clear it, you jump up and celebrate and go, here's what I learned. And you remember what you've learned, and you run back like you just did the best jump of your life. And then when you go to run, your nervous system will be in a place where it'll allow you to tap your peak levels of performance. As long as you hold things as failure, that prevents you from tapping peak levels of performance. And you want to be a peak performer, whether you be a father, a mother, a teacher, a student, a businessman, it doesn't matter. Peak performance is what we all are striving for, because that's where the joy is, when we're tapping more of who we are. And the only way that'll happen is you realize there are no failures, there are only outcomes. Just write down, I always succeed in producing a result. If it's not the one I intend, then I just learn from that and I change my approach and I'll produce a new result. And I'll keep changing until I produce the result that I intend. That's all it takes to succeed. Just remember, belief in failure is a way of poisoning the mind. When we store negative emotions about failure, we affect our physiology, our thinking processes, and our state. One of the greatest limitations for most people is their fear of failure. And I think Dr. Robert Schuller, who teaches the concept of possibility thinking, asked the best question to overcome that fear. He says, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? Think about it. How would you answer that? If you really believed you couldn't fail, you might take a whole new set of actions and produce a powerful new set of results for your life. Wouldn't you be better off trying them? Isn't that the only way to grow? So I suggest you start realizing right now that there is no such thing as failure, that there are only results. You always produce a result. If it's not the one you desire, you can just change your actions and you'll produce new results. Cross out the word failure from your personal dictionary and write in the word outcome, and commit yourself to learning from every human experience. Belief number 3 is whatever happens, take responsibility.
This is another attribute that great leaders and achievers have in common.
Achievers, no matter where we found them in the culture, no matter what they did, no matter what their background was, true leaders seem to have this as a common belief, that no matter what happened in their life, they were the source. At some level, they generated it. If not by their physical actions, by their mental actions. They seem to believe that they created whatever happened in their life. That was the bottom line. If somebody cut them off on the road even, on some level, they helped to contribute to that because they didn't pay attention close enough or they didn't anticipate. That's how leaders are. They take full responsibility. Now, this is not how most people in the culture respond, obviously. Large amounts of people in the culture, especially those who are failing on a consistent basis, come from the antithesis of this belief, and that is that they're a victim, that things happen to them, that things are beyond their control. So one of the first perceptual shifts that we like to share with people in terms of their belief structures is to operate from the belief system that you create your world. I mean, if you don't believe you create your world, then look at what the other opportunity is. Look at what you're going to have to believe then, that you are a puppet, that things happen to you, that you're a victim. I'd rather believe that I'm in charge and that I can have an effect. See, even if it's not true, at least if I believe that, I'll take action that can make a difference. See, if I believe I create my world and I don't like the way things are, then I can what? Change it. If I believe I'm a victim, then hey, there's nothing I can do. So I want to challenge you to adopt this belief system for your life. Adopt the belief that no matter what happens here, whether you're happy, sad, excited, energized, bored, interested, whatever it is, you create it. See, who generates whether you're bored or not? Is it a speaker? No, I'm sorry, it's not a speaker, right? What it is you. No matter how boring a person is, you can get excited about that. You can get fascinated by that. You can go, God, isn't it fascinating how he bores so many people? How does he do that? That's amazing. I mean, I've never seen somebody who could bore so many people so quickly. See, so you're still in charge. You're still responsible for your state. You're still responsible for the results that are generated. And the truth is, leaders operate from this frame. I remember hearing Dan Rather speak about John F. Kennedy years and years ago. And Rather was saying that he remembered the day that Kennedy became a true leader. He said it was right after the Bay of Pigs. Remember that? He said when he got up in front of the American people after the Bay of Pigs, and instead of saying, oh, the CIA did this, or we tried this or that, he just got up and he said, listen, it was an atrocity. It shouldn't have happened this way. I take full what?
Responsibility.
Yeah, he said that's the day he became a true leader. See, that's the next step. That's a major step in the level of increasing maturity that human beings take on. The key is to realize that no matter what happens in our life, we are in charge. Although some things may seem like they're happening to us, we can help to create new results. We can handle anything that happens. But we first need to adopt the philosophy or the belief that we control and direct our lives. Belief number 4, people are your greatest resource. Individuals of excellence, that is people who produce outstanding results, almost universally have a tremendous sense of respect and appreciation for people. They have a sense of team, a sense of common purpose and unity. If there's any insight at the heart of this new generation of business books like Innovation and Entrepreneurship or In Search of Excellence or The One-Minute Manager, is that there's no long-lasting success without rapport amongst people. The way to succeed is to form a successful team that's working together. We've all seen reports on the Japanese factories where workers and management eat in the same cafeteria and where both have input into evaluating performance. Their success reflects the wonders that can be achieved when we respect people rather than trying to manipulate them. When Thomas Peters and Robert Waterman Jr. wrote the book In Search of Excellence, they basically did modeling. They distilled the factors that made companies great. And one of the key things that they found was a passionate attention to people. There was hardly a more pervasive theme in excellent companies than respect for the individual. The companies that succeeded were the ones that treated people with respect and dignity. These companies viewed their employees as partners, not as tools. They noted that in one study, 18 of 20 Hewlett-Packard executives that they interviewed said the company's success depended on Hewlett-Packard's people-oriented philosophy. Hewlett-Packard isn't a retailer dealing with the public or a service company dependent upon goodwill. It's dealing at the most complex frontiers of modern technology, but even there, it's clear that dealing effectively with people is seen as the most important challenge a corporation's face. Like many of the beliefs we've talked about here, this one is easier to glibly mouth than to actually adopt. It's easy to pay lip service to the idea of treating people,
whether they be in your family or your business, with the kind of respect that they deserve. It's not always easy to do it. So as you move through your life, keep in your mind the constant desire to treat people with love and respect and appreciation. And have the acuity to note, do people feel respected by you? And if they don't, change your behaviors until they do. Belief number 5, work is play. Do you know any person who's achieved massive success by doing what he hates? I sure don't. One of the keys to success is making a successful marriage between what you do and what you love. Picasso once said, "When I work, I relax. Doing nothing or entertaining visitors makes me tired." Maybe we can't paint as well as Picasso, but we can do our best to find work that invigorates and excites us. And we can bring to whatever we do at work many of the aspects of what we do at play. Mark Twain said, "The secret of success is making your vocation your vacation." That's what successful people seem to do. We hear a lot about workaholics these days, and there are some people whose work has become something of an unhealthy obsession. They don't seem to get any pleasure out of their work, but they reach the point where they can't do anything else. Researchers are finding surprising things about some workaholics. There are some people who seem maniacally focused on work because they love it. It challenges them. It excites them. It makes their life richer. These people tend to look at work the way most of us look at play. They see it as a way to stretch themselves, to learn new things, to explore new avenues. By adopting this kind of belief, you change the quality of your life, since much of your life will be spent working. I'm not suggesting that you should choose to orient your world around your work, but I am suggesting that you'll enrich your world and enrich your work if you bring to it the same curiosity and vitality that you bring to your play. Finally, belief number 6. There is no abiding success without commitment. Individuals who succeed have a belief in the power of commitment. If there's a single belief that seems almost inseparable from success, it's that there's no great success without great commitment. If you look at successful people in any field, you'll find that they're not necessarily the best and the brightest, the fastest, or the strongest. You'll find they're the ones with the most commitment. The great Russian ballerina Anna Pavlova once said, quote, "To follow without halt one aim, there is the secret of success." Unquote. It's just another way of stating our ultimate success formula. Know your outcome, model what works, take action, develop sensory acuity to know what you're getting, and keep refining it until you get what you want. You know, we see this in any field, people with commitment overpowering those who seem to have greater natural ability. I mean, what makes Larry Bird one of the best players in basketball? A lot of people are still wondering. He's slow, he can't jump. In a world full of graceful gazelles, he sometimes looks like he's playing in slow motion. But when you come right down to it, Larry Bird succeeds because he has a massive commitment to success. He practices harder. He has more mental toughness. He gets more out of his skills than almost anyone else. Pete Rose has made his way into the record books the same way, by consistently using his commitment to excellence as a force, driving him to get everything he's got out of everything he does. Tom Watson, the great golfer, was nothing special at Stanford University, where he went to school. He was just another kid on the team. But his coach still marvels about Watson, saying, "I never saw anyone practice more." The difference in pure physical skills between athletes seldom tells you anything. It's the quality of commitment that separates the good from the great. Are there other beliefs that foster excellence? Sure there are. And when you think of them, so much the better. Adopt them in your own life. Remember, success leaves clues. Study those who succeed, find out about their key beliefs that they hold that enhance their ability to take effective action and apply them in your own life. We've talked so far about passion and about beliefs, but there's another key element we need to talk about next, and that is organizing a strategy for success.